Well, welcome to Walking Alongside Families in the Midst of Life-Changing Experiences. My name is Steph Hubach, and you can go to the next slide for me, please. Thanks. What I'd like to talk about today is just give you a little bit of introduction about myself and the type of ministry work that I do, and then talk really about four different phases that families go through when they're experiencing significant life-changing circumstances. And I will talk about the idea of coming to terms with a new reality, negotiating a path to acceptance, the idea of living a new normal life when a family finds their stride in the midst of life-changing circumstances, and then just touch briefly on the great opportunity that comes along with life-changing circumstances. Thanks. This is a picture of my family. That's my husband, Fred, on the right, and then my two sons, Tim and Freddie. These were taken a couple years ago, but my son, Fred, now is a senior in high school, and my son, Tim, is a freshman in high school, and he's my child that has Down syndrome. So that's how we got started in being involved with disability ministry. If you go to the next slide, thanks. Since May of 2007, I've been on staff with Mission in North America, which is an agency of the Presbyterian Church in America, as Special Needs Ministries Director. Prior to that, my husband Fred and I ran the Disability Ministry at Reformed Presbyterian in Ephrata, Pennsylvania for about 8 years. And I also serve on the Lancaster Christian Council on Disability, which is a group of six different Christian organizations in Lancaster County that speak with one voice on the subject of disability. So there have been a lot of neat things happening in disability ministry in the PCA and in other places around the country as well. And so it's kind of an exciting time to be involved in this type of ministry. If you would rather not take notes and just listen, pretty much everything I'm going to cover is in the central portion of my book, which is why it will feel like a marathon, because it probably shouldn't be one seminar. It should probably be two or three, but there's no pressure to purchase the book. If you would like to, though, it is on the book table outside. It's called Same Lake, Different Boat. And there's a center section of the book is on family issues, and so that's where the content for this comes from. I always start my seminars with a few stories about my son, Tim. Just is a real joy in our lives, and both our boys are, of course, and both of them actually are kind of fun, because Fred's on the gifted education end of the spectrum, and Tim's on the Down syndrome end of the spectrum, and so they're two perspectives that they live life together, and as they interact with each other are really pretty interesting sometimes. And this is a picture of Tim at his job. There's a Christian camp up the road from us at where we live in Lancaster, and Tim works there in the kitchen, and the funny thing was, the first time that I found out he worked in the kitchen, I didn't realize he had a job yet, because I went up to the pool and the pool director said, "Oh, we got to talk sometime about Tim's schedule." And I was like, "Schedule for what?" And he said, "To schedule for his job." He said he told me he needed a job, so I gave him a job in the kitchen. So Tim got his own first job, and he works in the kitchen sorting paper products. And so he's in this little cubicle where they, when people are done with their paper products, they put them through the window, and then he sorts them into bowls and plates and all that. Well, there's this sign on the door that goes into the kitchen area, and it says, you know, in bold letters, "Employees only." And so one day, that fellow who's the owner of the camp comes out of that door into Tim's workspace, and he's carrying a big tray of food because he's taking it across the road to his house and taking it home for dinner for his kids. And so Tim looks at Marlon, and he looks at the sign, and he just starts glaring at him. And Tim points to the door, and he says, "Employees only," you know. And I said, "Well, Tim, it's Mr. Harnish. He's the guy that owns the whole camp." And he said, "Maybe so, but he doesn't work in the kitchen." So that's just that's kind of Tim's take on the world. So anyway, what I'd like to talk about today is just the idea that when and what I'm going to do is I'll talk about life-changing circumstances from the perspective of disability, because that's my personal experience, and that's where my ministry experience lies. But there are, I think you can easily make extrapolations to other areas where families might be going through dramatic life changes by just using the same principles. So my examples will be disability related, but I think you can make extrapolations. And I think that the first thing that you have to acknowledge is just the idea that that when families are walking through life-changing experiences, it's simply complicated. You know, I mean, we what we really want is the picture on the left there. You know, the idea of something, even if it's not exactly linear, it's at least predictable or follows a singular path. And yet, I think in reality, the picture on the right better represents what it's like dealing with a family that's going through dramatic changes. It's much more dynamic, interactive, and messy than we really ideally would like it to be. And so a lot of times our struggles in working with families who are in crisis or are struggling comes from our own desire to just have things more A, B, C, D, you know, than they really work out. That said, I'm going to present this A, B, C, D because what I'll do is I'll present to you four phases that in my experience, families go through as they are coming to terms with significant changes in their lives. That said, those changes and those four phases don't happen in a linear, independent fashion. You often will start at A and at the same time start something in D and then go back to B, and just when you think you've wrapped up C, you're back in parts of A again, okay? And so while I'm gonna present them as four distinct units, I just wanna stress that I don't think that they happen in a particularly orderly fashion. So as I said, I'd like to cover these four things: the idea of coming to terms with the new reality, the whole concept of just simply what does a family face with the onset of disability. Next, the idea of negotiating a path to acceptance. What does a family deal with as they attempt to embrace new circumstances in their life? The idea of living a new normal life, which is what does a family experience as they try to actively incorporate the realities of disability into their daily existence. And then the last one, which I'll just do briefly if we have time, which is grappling with the great opportunity. What are the great opportunities that come to a family through the experience of living with disability? So the first one, coming to terms with the new reality. I love this quote by St. Gregory of Nyssa. It says, "Mercy is a voluntary sorrow which joins itself to the suffering of another." And I think it just really captures the essence of what a family is experiencing and what they need from the church when they're in a time of crisis. So let's talk about that a little bit more. What is a family experiencing with the onset of disability? That was interesting that Diane used that September 11th experience. I'm going to use it from a little different vantage point. I think if you think about it, in some ways we become almost immune to this picture because we've seen it so much. But if you allow yourself to go back to the morning of September 11th and when that happened and the types of emotions that you felt as those events were unfolding in real time, I think that really helps you to understand what families go through with the onset of disability. In many ways, it's like a September 11th experience. If you remember how you felt, it's shocking. It was shocking to watch the events unfold. There's a sense of disbelief. It's difficult to fathom that what was actually happening and to come to terms with what any of it meant. There's a sense that somehow what was unfolding was going to change life forever, and yet you didn't know how. Just a realization that life would never be the same again, that your perspective on life would probably never be the same again. It was a harsh reality, you know, watching people jump from windows and knowing that in real time they were jumping to their death. They're just the raw, searing pain associated with the amount of death and sorrow that was happening all at one time. I just think the feelings that most of us can identify with from September 11th are ones that help us understand what a family goes through with the onset of disability. And if you think about in that whole spectrum of emotions, there are three prominent ones that I think you'll find on a fairly predictable basis, and those are grief, anger, and fear. If grief is a normal response to loss, and disability can represent all different types of loss. It can represent the loss of expectations. You know, parents are expecting a child, a typical child, to be born, and all of a sudden they have a child with significant disabilities. There's a loss of expectations that comes with that. There can be a loss of capacity, right? One day you're able to walk and drive, and the next day you've been in a car accident and you're quadriplegic, and right, there's a dramatic loss of capacity. There can be the loss of the person in terms of personality of a person that you once knew through dementia. It's not the loss of the personhood. I want to be very clear about that. That's still very much a real person in the image of God, but your accessibility to that person's personality becomes increasingly limited. And there can be a loss of hopes and dreams. And we'll talk about some of that as we go through this. So the emotion of grief is very real, and it's a very normal response to the losses that can be associated with disability. The second one is anger. And as Christians, we often don't really like to talk about anger, but it is a human emotion that you can't avoid when you're dealing with people who are going through life-changing experiences. Anger is a stage of the grief process, and it comes when we realize that we're not in control. And we'll talk about that a little bit too. And often we've deluded ourselves that we are. So it can be quite a shocking experience that we often respond to with anger. So my advice to you is that you should expect to encounter angry people as you encounter people who are in the midst of life-changing circumstances or in the midst of trying to process the onset of disability. And of course, the third one is fear. And fear of the unknown just creates anxiety in people. And they start to ask questions, now that this has happened, what will I do? How will I cope? Where will funding come from? Where will supports come from? How will people treat me now? Or how will people treat my loved one? Who will care for them when I'm not here? Who will help me right now? Right? There are a lot of questions that arise immediately that cause feelings of fear. So when you enter into the world of a family through the onset of disability, you will run into grief, anger, and fear, and you should expect that. Let's talk next about what are some of the specific things that families are actually experiencing in real time as they're trying to deal with the onset of disability or a new diagnosis. I'll go through these slide by slide, so we can just switch over to the next one. The first one is this idea of family adjustments. Everybody goes through family adjustments when a new baby is born into the family. But when a baby is born with significantly disabling conditions and all of a sudden the parents are living out of Children's Hospital, in Philadelphia, there are huge family adjustments that need to take place in order for that family to just respond to the new circumstances they have. So one of the important things to remember is that disability really is a family affair. It doesn't just affect the person that has the disability or who's born with the disability or becomes disabled, but it affects the entire family. And when our son Tim was born, Freddie was not quite two yet, and his life changed dramatically overnight. His world went from a fairly carefree existence where I was home all the time to a very stress-filled household where nobody was home very much of the time, and he was not home very much of the time. Tim had a lot of medical issues when he was an infant, and so we spent a lot of time, because we're from Lancaster, we were at Hershey, So Freddie, so while we are incredibly grateful for the care that he received from his grandparents and from friends at church and from our neighbors, it still, for him, for a two-year-old, was a very disruptive experience for him. And that level of disruption will be different for every family depending on what the situation is, right? If it's the wage earner who becomes disabled, then that creates a whole different kind of family adjustment that needs to take place. Or if it's a spouse, right, if the sibling, so. The next thing is the whole question of medical issues. Virtually every disabling condition has some level of medical involvement and often a team of medical professionals that need to be involved. So frequent doctor appointments and life-threatening conditions often become just a natural part of life of living with a disability. And yet, when this just happens overnight, and all of a sudden you're thrust into this world, it's quite a dramatic change to make. When, as I mentioned earlier, Tim had a lot of medical issues. He had congestive heart failure and and you got pneumonia and you got bacterial spinal meningitis and that heart catheterization, open heart surgery, all that in the first 7 months that he was born. And so after he was born, and so it was just really a whirlwind of, you know, of activity and life-threatening activity as well. Another thing that comes up in the context of the medical issues is this, the whole question of bioethics. Most people, most Christians, are not really well versed in issues related to bioethics and can find themselves faced with really difficult life and death kind of and treatment issue questions that they don't feel theologically prepared to answer. So one book I would recommend to you, I recommended this to everybody because I think this is a tremendously helpful book that anybody can read that helps them to frame how to think biblically about some of these issues, is a book by Gilbert Mylander called Bioethics, A Primer for Christians. And what I like about the book is it's not a rules-oriented book that you can or can't do these 10 things, but a principle-driven book that says this is how to think biblically about life and death issues. So it's family adjustments, medical issues, financial issues. Financial issues are just in part, or natural byproduct of the medical issues. You know, everyone knows that medical care is extremely expensive, and so right off the bat, even if you have a decent insurance policy, you can still have very high copays. There are a lot of non-medical costs of hospitalization. If you're a parent and your child's in the hospital for 3 weeks and you're there, you still have to eat. You know, and if they don't allow you to sleep in their room, you have to sleep somewhere too. And if there's no Ronald McDonald House, then you have a hotel bill. So there are a lot of expenses like that. If you have someone who becomes physically disabled and you have to make handicap accessible modifications to your house, if you can, you may live in a home where you can't do that, which would require moving, selling a house. So there can be a lot of financial impact right off the bat. The next thing is this idea of concerns for the future. In addition to concerns over finances, there's also a concern for the future. And so, for example, you could have a couple who's right on the verge of retirement, and one of the and this happens all the time. You know, one of the two has a stroke. One of them comes down with Alzheimer's, right? And so, all of a sudden, there's a dramatic shift in how everyone is looking at the future and preparations for that. Parents could have well thought out financial plans for their children, and all of a sudden they have a severely disabled child is born into the family, and then that affects how they look at not only their child's future, but the sibling's future and at their own future. And parents who have kids with disabilities know that that's a constant concern, is the idea of who will care for my child when I'm gone? You know, what kind of supports are there either in the community or within my family system to make sure that my child is cared for in my absence? So, parents think too, as far as their children go, what will my child's life be like, right? What is their life gonna be like? What kind of opportunities will be available to him? Will he have friends, right? And then quickly after that question, if we're honest, comes the question, how will my life be different, you know, as a result of my child's disability? So there are concerns for the future. There also are legal issues, and this may sound like sort of a dry point, but it can be and it may sound like a long-term thing, but it's not always a long-term thing. For example, when someone develops dementia, sometimes there are asset reallocations that need to be made and wills that need to be changed and all, while the person is still able to make some of those decisions in order to make sure that they are going to have the services that they need available to them. And so sometimes legal issues really become very immediate. And often they're the type of thing that people just do not have energy to really, I mean, it's the last thing you want to do, and sometimes one of the first things you need to do. And so legal issues are something you should be aware can be part of the mix of just the onset of disability. Another one is social issues. And, you know, you can have previously comfortable relationships with people that develop some kind of tension now because those people are uncomfortable with the whole idea of disability, or they're uncomfortable with the changes that are coming about in your life because of that. Because they may be dealing with some of their own prejudices that they didn't realize they had until your family member developed a disability. You can all of a sudden run into well-meaning but boundary-violating people who are well-intentioned and wanting to help you, but are offering more assistance than you may want, or assistance that comes in a different form than what you're really looking for. Sometimes strangers can make social situations uncomfortable. I remember when Timmy was a baby, and I would go grocery shopping, you know, get these ladies that would come by, you know, the grocery cart, and Tim's in the little thing up front, you know, and you go by, and they, you know, of course, they'd see a baby, so they'd want to come over and say hi, and as soon as they would see that he had Downs, you'd see them physically back away, you know, and then they would, when I went past, they would go, aw, you know, and so I just have to just trying to prepare myself for that before I would even go to the grocery store, and then I would have to decide in advance whether this was a day that I had the emotional energy to do any education or whether I was just gonna, you know, kind of let that go. And so even social issues in the early stages can be significant. And then of course also testing of their faith. I mean, the onset of a major life change, you know, can be a real faith testing experience. And the onset of disability is really no exception to that. I mean, questions come up like, where is God in all of this? Does he care? You know, did he cause it? Right? Will he help me? Can I trust him? I mean, very real, legitimate faith questions come up in people's minds as they are processing the onset of disability. So on the one hand, it can expose weaknesses in our faith and an opportunity for growth. I'll give you an example. In my own life, I think I carried around, you know, we all carry around different myths that we don't really realize that we have until something kind of tests them. And I think one of mine was this idea that, well, if I'm good, there's so much theologically wrong with this. I'm just confessing my previous myth. If I'm good, bad things won't happen to me, right? I mean, so when Tim's, you know, when Tim was born and we went through all these difficulties with Tim, that myth, you know, had to be addressed, you know, and so I really had to really search the scriptures and kind of understand that really was not a biblical way of thinking about quote unquote my own goodness, which did not is not there, nor necessarily that this was a bad thing per se either. And so, and on the other end, it can really strengthen areas where you have strengths in your faith already. I think I already had a strong belief in the sovereignty of God, and I think that was only strengthened more, you know, through Tim's birth into our family. So, you know, how can you help in the initial onset of disability or another significant life-altering change? I think the three things that families really need are privacy, presence, and normalcy. And I say privacy because these are a lot of changes to go through at one time. You know, you don't get to do one, number one, and then number two, you know, all 8 or 10 or whatever hit at the same, you know, often at the same time. And Fred and I used to say God was very gracious in that while life was a roller coaster, it seemed like one of us would be right at the top while the other one was right at the bottom. We were glad that we were rarely both, you know, careening down the hill at the same time. So, but it does say privacy in order to really process it. So from the privacy perspective, I guess what I would say is don't expect people to be able to articulate necessarily even what they're experiencing or to have it figured out, you know, in the first couple of weeks or the first couple of months, even for not the first couple of years. So people do need, you know, privacy, but that said, they also need presence, you know, and so it's having the wisdom to know where do I give someone space and where do I need to enter in, because one of the biggest fears I think people have is that they'll be abandoned, that no one will be there for the long haul for them, for these significant things that they're facing in their life. So it's really important for the church to be an active, real presence of the hands and feet of Jesus in the lives of families. And so that can look like a lot of different things. It can involve just visiting. It can involve attending doctor appointments with the family in order to be of some assistance there, cleaning the house, bringing meals. There's lots of ways you can be a practical presence in the life of a family. And the third one is this idea of normalcy, which is simply that, you know, the sooner the family can experienced some semblance of what normalcy used to feel like, and at least in the ways that they can still do that, that just helps with the amount of stress. And so, and what you have to do is you have to ask them what they need in order to understand what that is. Don't just stand from the outside and guess and just do things at a family. You really need to communicate with them and ask them. And if they're not in a position to even be able to figure that out, you can help them work their way through figuring that out. I'll give you a quick example. For us, Freddie turned two. His two-year-old birthday was like 10 days after Tim was born. And Tim had just gotten out of his second round of the hospital and come home on oxygen and a monitor. And I just was not in a position to make a birthday cake, you know? And it wasn't that I didn't remember, I didn't care. I just physically couldn't do it. But I had a Christian next door neighbor who had a little girl Freddie's age who knew that. And so she called me up and said, don't worry about Freddie's birthday. I'll make a cake. I'll bring games and presents and we'll have a party. Do you know what I mean? And so she brought games, presents, kids, party, you know? I mean, and that was just a really important thing because it allowed Freddie and the rest of us in the family to experience a moment of normalcy in the midst of what otherwise had been a very tumultuous and chaotic experience up to that point. So that's, and the reason I have this picture on here is another example of normalcy. This is a picture from Tim's baptism, right? And one of the things that we forget sometimes, we get so focused on the difficulty and the adjustment and all with the disability. Yes, the disability is not celebratory, but the person's life always is, you know? And so a newborn baby into the church, disability or not, should always be celebrated. You know, their baptism should be a moment of celebration. Their presence should be celebrated. Parents should be congratulated on the birth of a baby with a disability just like any other baby, because that child also has a child of the covenant and also a child that has gifts to share with the body of Christ. And so, and we sometimes torque over on this, you know, and only focus on the difficulty. So I just put the baptism picture in there to remind you, you know, that this is an important element of normalcy in the life of a Christian family, so. All right, the second one, that was coming to terms with a new reality, the whole idea of onset of disability. This next one is negotiating a path to acceptance. And I really like this quote. Jane Petit gave this to me. She got it from Paul Settle, and I don't know where Paul Settle got it from. So it's attributed to Anonymous, but it says, "Peace is the deliberate adjustment of my life to the will of God." And I think that really captures, you know, what the whole pathway to acceptance is about. You know, negotiating a path to acceptance, you know, at its heart really has to do with dealing with some of the ultimate questions about life and coming to terms with the answers to those. One of the stories I like to tell is about, this is a picture of our family in Maine. My husband's family has a cabin in Maine that's been in the family for generations, and all of the firstborn males on my husband's side of the family are named Fred. So my son Freddie is the seventh Frederick Kubach, you know, so all these Freds in Maine at the same time on vacation. So anyway, one year we were out up there, and Fred the grandfather and Fred the father and Freddie the seven-year-old, you know, we're all out fishing together in the boat. And one of the things I personally have never really come to appreciate about fishing is the part where you just sit there, you know, forever. And if they're biting, it's fun. If they're not, I want to go home. So anyway, Freddie had been in the boat for 2 hours in the hot sun, and they hadn't caught anything. And he finally, this exasperated look, he looks at his dad and his grandfather, and he said, "We're experiencing a bad hand of providence," you know. And which is pretty funny coming out of a seven-year-old. But that really is sort of the question, though, that a lot of families who are struggling with the issue of acceptance are asking themselves. They're saying, are we experiencing a bad hand of providence? I mean, it really causes them to say, to question, you know, when their experiences or their expectations in life are banging up against some hard realities, it really causes time to think through some of these essential questions about God and his character. And questions, you know, questions, all these questions come up about God's character, the cause of difficulty, is this a punishment? I mean, if I had a dollar for every Christian family I know who's heard, you know, some kind of comment made about, you know, a disability or hardship in their life that's a function of punishment or judgment, you know, there's still people out there that put that kind of stuff on other people. So their families are often trying to go through a lot of these questions in their mind. So let's talk a little bit about acceptance. If, you know, we talk about a definition, this is the best definition I could come up with for the concept of acceptance, and that it's the idea of developing peace about the presence of disability in the life of a family. And, you know, the Bible really teaches, I don't have time to get into this, but in my book I talk about this, that the idea that difficulty is a normal part of life in an abnormal world, right? And that in that sense, we should expect it. We shouldn't be surprised by it, that living in a world where things are not as they were intended to be, that difficulty is a normal part of life in a world that is filled with brokenness and difficulty. But we spend a lot of our time in life trying to deny that or trying to get around that reality. I have a friend that says that disability isn't like cancer. You can't get to the other side of it. And that's not to diminish anybody who has struggled with cancer, because not everybody gets to the other side of cancer either. But some people do. And in disability, you never get to the other side of it. It requires a complete paradigm shift in terms of how you actually adapt your life. So it really involves the whole idea of embracing life as it is and not as we wish it would be. And so I guess the two points related to that would be the idea that acceptance really is a process. It's not an event. And a lot of times we would like to rush people through this because we don't like to stick with people through a long process. You know, we're willing to give, you know, 15 minutes for an event, but acceptance is a process, so, and it also involves embracing reality as it actually is. If you think about it, the whole process of acceptance really is, in a sense, a form of conflict. As you're trying to embrace reality as it is, you have to come to terms with a number of different things that you need to resolve. And so in some ways it may seem paradoxical, but the pathway to peace often is through conflict. And so achieving a peace about the presence of disability in the life of a family requires engaging in a struggle. And what I would emphasize is that often in our, because we don't like to walk alongside a person in a process, we try to rush them rush them to resolution. And here's the saying, if you go home with one thought, rushed resolution results in resignation. Okay, if we try to rush someone through a process and don't give them the time to actually achieve resolution, they actually end up in a point where they're just resigned to it. And that's a false peace. That's not actually coming to peace with it. So in order to actually embrace the reality of disability and achieve peace in the life of a family, I think you have to do these five things. The first one is this idea of releasing expectations. This often is one of the most heart-wrenching things. All of us have ideas in our minds of what we think life is going to be like, or what we think our kids are going to be like, or what we think our marriage is going to be like, or what we think our retirement is going to be like. And there's a grief associated with releasing those expectations and embracing what God's given us instead. And that can be a very deep kind of grief for a lot of people. When I was pregnant with Tim, we went on a family vacation to Myrtle Beach and with friends of ours from college, and there was a picture of me and Freddie from the beach on my mom's refrigerator. After Tim was born, I looked at it and I realized I was pregnant with Tim during that picture, and kind of struck me that this was actually a very healing moment for me, because it struck me that, oh wow, I was pregnant with Tim in that picture. I said, and Tim has had Down syndrome since he was conceived. You know, Tim always had Down syndrome. From the moment he was conceived, he had Down syndrome. I just didn't know it. You know, I mean, the only thing that changed when he was born was I was clued in now. You know, nothing about Tim had actually changed all along. And there was something very comforting, I think, to me about that. It was, and that was one of the things that allowed me to realize that it wasn't Tim that needed to change, it was just me that needed to change in terms of my expectations about what his life and mine were going to look like. The second area of conflict is this idea of redirecting to a new life. If you think about the analogy of an earthquake, right? If you look at areas in the world where there have been earthquakes, and team goes in afterwards and does an initial assessment of what's happened, and they make a plan to redirect life and a lot of times the degree of devastation in any area where an earthquake is struck really varies, right? It kind of depends on what the construction was like before, how solid was the construction, and how was it intentionally built to withstand an earthquake or not, versus places where no thought was put into that or there were no resources towards that at all. You'll have completely different outcomes, to the same 6.0 on the Richter scale, depending on different areas. And so in some ways, it's the same way with families. You can have families that have a significant onset of disability, but it doesn't take them down, and then you can have families that have actually fairly nominal disability, but it completely disrupts family life. And so in some ways, I think there's an analogy there. But as far as rebuilding goes, the whole point, though, is you don't want to rebuild life. You can't rebuild life as it was. That's the whole point of disability. You can't go back to what you had before. You have to build a new life that incorporates disability into it. And so for folks who refuse to do that and keep insisting on trying to rebuild the life they had before, that's an exercise in futility that creates a lot of anger and frustration. So the pathway to peace, pathway to acceptance, is finding ways to embrace the new life that has been given to you and incorporate disability into that. I'll give you another beach story. Sounds like the only thing we ever did was go to the beach, but we hardly ever go to the beach. But when Tim was probably about 6 months old, we were at the beach, and I was walking down the beach holding him, and I walked by these ladies. There were about 10 of them in chairs, 10 elderly ladies sitting in these chairs on the beach. And then there were two of them that were building this little sand wall. So they were, they were a couple of feet away from where the surf was coming in. And as soon as the surf would hit the little wall, it was there to try to keep their feet dry. So as soon as the surf would hit the wall, then the two ladies would run back and they'd build the wall up again, right? And then the surf would hit the wall and the ladies would run back and build the wall up. And I'm watching this exercise in futility, right? Because the tide is coming in. And it struck me, move the chairs, right? The point is to move the chairs. And then it struck me at the same time that this was a picture of my life. I was trying to rebuild my life as it was before Tim was born, but it was God's picture showing me, move the chairs, Dad, get up and move the chair. And so that's the whole idea of if when we embrace and a willingness to redirect to a new life that incorporates the kink into it, we'll experience a level of acceptance and peace. The third thing is the idea of responsibility. Incorporating responsibility is an important element of acceptance. There are, with disability come a new realms of responsibility, and it depends on the situation, but it can be, a child with a disability can be all sorts of different therapies, occupational speech, vision, cognitive, physical therapy. Can be, as I mentioned before, medical appointments, could be feeding techniques. It could be meeting with social workers, teachers, and therapists. It could be rehab for a person that has a stroke or is in a car accident. It could involve increased needs of siblings who are feeling, the stress of being squeezed in the family system. So one of my favorite quotes about responsibility, there's a book called The Power of the Powerless by Christopher DeVink. And Christopher had a brother named Oliver who had significant disabilities, unable to speak, unable to see, unable to feed himself, significantly disabled. And Oliver lived to be 32. And could someone help? I'm here with the door. Michelle, do you need some help with the door? You okay? All right, thanks. And Oliver lived to be 32, and Christopher asked his dad one day, he said, Dad, how did you care for Oliver for 32 years? And he said, it wasn't 32 years. He said, every day I woke up and I said, can I feed Oliver today? And then he said, yes, I can. So he said, and Christopher DeVink's quote then after that is, we lived with Oliver moment by moment, you know, and that incorporating new responsibilities into life when there are life-changing circumstances really involves learning to live life moment by moment in dependency on God for the strength that we need to do the task in front of us. The next thing is this idea of relinquishing control. Remember, we're talking about a pathway to acceptance. Control is an illusion. It's just one that most of us enjoy. You know, we all think we have a lot more control over events than we really do. I know we all say that we realize God is in control, but our behaviors and our attitudes and our actions often belie that statement. Not that it's not true, just that we don't live like it's true. And so sometimes, you know, the onset of disability and the whole concept of dealing with acceptance really causes us to ask questions. Who's really in charge here, right? Who's really in control of my life? And it really puts us at a philosophical fork in the road where we, you know, have to ask ourselves, is God sovereign and good, or is he not? Right? And if you think about it, I have a friend that says that all relationships are built on the like bridges with the two trusses being trust and respect. You know, and so can we trust God? You know, if God is not powerful, I can't really trust him to come through for me, right? And if God's not good, then he's not worthy of my respect. So there's the trust and the respect issue. And so it forces you to really look at this question and really come to terms with that. And hopefully you come to terms with that in a way that really is biblical, which is that God is sovereign and God is good. God's great and good. And that he really releases his power when we relinquish ours. And so part of the pathway to acceptance is really, really opening our hands and letting go of areas where we've tried to exercise control and recognize God's, not only God's sovereignty, but his goodness as well. And the last thing in terms of acceptance is just this idea of realizing the benefits. I think you really have made a lot of progress in the area of acceptance when you get to the point that you can say, even though life is difficult, it's not all negative, right? Even though the disability, for example, is difficult, it's not all negative. One of the reasons I like this picture, this is kids with Downs have hyperflexive joints, which means they are extremely flexible. This is Timmy at the beach. You know, I can't do that. I'd hurt myself if I tried to do that. But there are just, you know, for us there have been tremendous benefits of, and blessings that have come from having Tim in our lives. And when you stop focusing on the difficulty and instead focus on God's goodness in the midst of difficulty, it really changes, you know, your perspective on things. And it really takes you a long way down the pathway of acceptance. You know, Tim definitely has differences, but his differences have taught us to see differently. They've taught us to live differently. They've taught us to love differently than we did before, and it's a better kind of different. And so being able to really realize the benefits of and the blessings that have come with Tim's disabilities has been just a real gift to us, and that Tim has a wonderful type of giftedness. It's just in different packaging. You know, he has a really funny sense of humor. I mean, we live in Lancaster, and so there are a lot of Amish, you know, in the area where we live, and if you know very much about the Amish, as a rule, they're fairly serious, you know, to be people for the most part. So I put Tim in the cart, and we're riding into Walmart. He was about 6, and we pass this Amish guy, and he yells out, "Hey, nice cowboy hat," you know, and this Amish guy just cracks up, and, you know, it's just Tim just has a way of you know, helping people loosen up. The guy got a good kick out of that. But he's also unfortunately been known to call cash registers babe and things like that, so we've had to work on a few of those social skills. But we've had cashiers that have thanked me before that, but, oh, no one said anything that flattering to me in years. So, but anyway, so how can you help for a family that's going through issues related to acceptance? Two things, basically. Patience and permission for the process. Remember, acceptance is not an event, it's a process. And so just remember that idea that rushed resolution results in resignation. It's messy and time-consuming and an angst-ridden process to go down the pathway of acceptance. But giving people the time and the space and the sounding board to work that out is just a real blessing. And often in the church, we're guilty of rushing people through messy things, not for their benefit, but for ours. The second is just modeling the life of Jesus, full of grace and truth. People who are really wrestling with acceptance issues, really, they need safe truth tellers in their life. You know, they need people who will hold biblical truth before them, that they will remind them that God is both great and good, right? But that they will do it with great grace and not with judgment. So just be full of grace and truth as you engage people who are wrestling down that pathway. All right, the next thing, and again, remember, we don't do onset acceptance, normalcy, right? New normal life. It's all sort of intertwined, but the next major phase I think a family goes through, even as they're negotiating these other pieces, is this idea of living a new normal life. Probably my favorite book on this subject is written by Helen Featherstone. It's called A Difference in the Family. And this quote, I think, has been tremendously helpful. As far as I can tell, Helen Featherstone is not a Christian author, but this is the most honest book I've ever read about assessment of family issues for families with children with disabilities. And so I think it's a very illuminating read. My favorite quote from her in the book says that differences differ only in degree from those of other families. Differences differ only in degree from those of other families. And the reason I find that helpful, I think it's helpful from both perspectives. I think it's helpful for a family with a disability who starts to have a pity party to remember that their differences are only in degree from those of other families and not necessarily absolute differences. It's helpful for people who are trying to identify with a family who's been touched by disability to say, okay, if I can think about these things that are hard for me, then I can extrapolate, right, a difference of degree of that thing and try to understand what it must be like for my friend in this situation. So I think it's helpful for perspective in both directions. We talked about the whole idea that about the 9/11 experience, you know, September 11th experience with disability, what the onset feels like. But you know, there comes a time and a phase in life of a family where a family starts to begin to find their stride. They start to learn how do we actively incorporate disability into our lives? How do we start to live a normal life that's a new type of normal for us? And the reason I have this picture up here is because I think a crucial thing that happens in this phase is a family has to start to differentiate between what's a crisis and what just is a situation that needs support, right? And if you look at the picture on the left, I have the ambulance, you know, and the telephone off the hook there, you know, the 911 idea. And so it becomes essential that family starts to differentiate between what's a crisis and where do they just need practical supports. I think one of my favorite Timmy stories with this application was that we were at a friend's house in State College visiting one weekend, and I was out in the kitchen drinking coffee with my friend, and Tim came in with this Star Wars lightsaber, you know, and the light in it wasn't working, and he showed it to me, and I said, you know, it's okay, you can still play with it, you know, you can still swashbuckle around, won't matter that the light doesn't work. So he went off, and I went back to having coffee with my friend, and a few minutes later, he started calling me, and he kept calling me, so I said, Tim, what do you need? And he said, it's the phone, it's for you. And I said, how can it be for me? This isn't my house, you know? And it wasn't a cell phone, it was a landline. So I went in the room, and he hands me the receiver, and I picked it up, and it was a 911 operator. And, you know, he said that characteristically, kind of nasally voice, and I said, hello, it's a 911 operator. We understand that there's someone in your house is choking on a lifesaver. And I'm looking at, you know, I'm glaring at Tim, you know, at this point. And I said, no, there's no one here choking on a lifesaver. And she said, are you sure? The child on the phone insisted there's someone choking on a lifesaver. And she said, we've already dispatched the ambulance. And I was like, no. I started begging with her, no, please stop the ambulance. And so I got off the phone and I said to Tim, I said, what were you doing? And he said, he holds up the lightsaber and he said, I have a broken lightsaber. He called 911 because the light bulb was out. And she thought he said choking on a lifesaver when he said, I have a broken lightsaber. So, but Tim's dilemma was the same dilemma that you see in families sometimes, the inability to differentiate between the light bulb needs to be changed, right? Versus we need an ambulance, right? And if you get in family ministry with families affected by disability, you will find that there are families that have difficulty differentiating, you know, between the two. And yet, in order to provide for the family to be healthy and in order to provide good boundaries in the way that you're ministering in the church, you have to be able to tell the difference between the two. So what I want to do is just talk about, if Helen Featherston says that differences are really only differences of degree, then let's just talk about what are some of those differences of degree that families affected by disability will face, and then we'll talk to you a little bit about boundaries and how to tell whether you need the ambulance or whether you need the light bulb, right? So, okay, and we'll do these quickly. Personal care, you know, and this is, again, I'll tell you, this is what a typical family would do, right? And this is how the difference exists in the disability world, right? So, for example, feeding and personal care are a normal part of infant care, right? For any family who has small children. And something that you can expect to have to do to feed children by hand and change diapers till they're 2 or 3 years old, right? But for a family affected by disability, often the need to assist in feeding and to toileting and all can last for a lifetime, right? So there's an example of a difference of degree that exists in the area of personal care for some families. For individuals who have spinal cord injuries, bladder and bowel management programs become a normal part of life. That's a difference of degree. That's something different than what a typical person would have to deal with. Next area is the area of education. You know, the thing we can all say that we understand in common is that all parents want a good education for their children, and that's true of parents with kids with special needs. But the level of complexity for education is a whole lot greater, and because you have more teachers and more therapists and often special education programs to deal with. And the schooling starts much earlier. Timmy started early intervention classes when he was 5 weeks old. So you don't, you know, your kids don't start at kindergarten. They're 5 years old. They start at 5 weeks old. And so there's a difference of degree there. And it adds a level of complexity, you know, to family life that doesn't exist for other families. And the area of education, too, this whole question of Christian schooling. And if you're on the board of a Christian school or whatever, I'd ask you to think through the question, you know, what are our covenantal responsibilities to families with kids with disabilities? Sometimes people have very strong feelings about things like Christian school, but then they don't make it open to everybody. And so that, and I'm not saying that's easy to do. I'm just saying you have to think through that these questions do add a certain level of complexity. And for parents who are really committed to Christian education, for example, for their kids, this is a difficult question. Behavior. All parents want to teach their children self-control, right? I mean, everybody could agree on that. But behavioral challenges can be a significant part of living with certain types of disabilities. So it takes a lot of creativity and energy and persistence to teach appropriate behaviors to some kids with special needs. And for children with intellectual or communication disorders, it can also take a lot of discernment to understand if what you're seeing is actually a misbehavior or only just a limited ability to communicate and the only way that person can communicate what it is they're trying to tell you. So it takes a lot of discernment in order to be able to understand some of those things, which makes, you know, this is an aside, but makes parental discipline really challenging sometimes for kids with disabilities, especially intellectual disabilities, when you don't understand for sure what they do and don't understand. That said, it doesn't mean kids with disabilities automatically get a get-out-of-jail-free card like a Monopoly, right? That means they are not held accountable for their actions either. And so they're, you know, they find a fine line here between trying to understand those things. And that's just a challenge for parents and people that work with kids with disabilities. Time management. Time management is a challenge for everybody in the 21st century. No, it seems like nobody has enough margin, right, in their lives. And for families affected by disability, this is just true more so because there are just more demands on the life of a family affected by disability due to additional doctor's appointments, what we affectionately used to call the parade of therapists, you know, that we come through. And we appreciated every one of them. They had a tremendous impact on Tim's life. But the parade of therapists in our lives when Tim was little completely monopolized our home life for years, really. And so there's the blessing of specialists and the complexity with time management that comes with that. Another thing is social isolation. You know, all families have some level of preference about their social involvement. Some families by choice like to be very socially involved. Some by choice like to be more remotely connected. That's by temperament. But often in the case of disability, it's not a choice. You know, the family, for one reason or another, may be more socially isolated than they want to be just by virtue of their circumstances. And so can be due to transportation issues, can be due to behavioral issues. It can just be due to really challenging social interactions. And so sometimes it's just, too much work for family to go out because it just, you know, they've just had too many meltdowns in the restaurant, you know, or too many times they've gone to churches and been asked not to come back. So it's just those kind of things can really make things challenging. You know, when Tim was little, he was just one of these kids that for whatever reason, he's outgrown this fortunately, but when he was little, every time he would get excited, he would throw up. So it meant that anywhere you went that was fun, it became inevitable. So I learned to adapt over time. I always carried an extra shirt, or I bought one at the gift shop. I learned how to be a lot more flexible than I was originally. But we were, you know, at Park City Mall one time and got shoes, you know, and I told him if, you know, the shoe shopping went well, that we would ride the merry-go-round afterwards. And so we're standing in line at the merry-go-round, and he's standing there, and he goes, "Oh, my belly hurts." And I leaned over, and I said, "Well, let me listen to your tummy." Yep, so he threw up on my head, and and you know, there are just things like that when that happens over and over again, you know, you just become a little shy of what kind of situations you want to enter into. And you know, it's kind of funny with those with Tim, but for someone who has a child with autism with significant behavioral challenges, you know, just a trip to Walmart can be extremely stressful, you know. So social isolation is sometimes an unwanted byproduct. That's a difference of degree, you know, that families can struggle with. Let's see, I'm almost done here. It's got two more here. Access and advocacy. Again, all parents like to work for opportunities for their kids, you know, and they're willing to do that. Most parents really love their kids and want to see them succeed at whatever it is they're doing and work towards opportunities for them to do that, whether it's in sports or school or whatever. Just parents of kids with disabilities have to do that more so. They, you know, if you have a typical child and they go to public school, the school will arrive at your door or your corner when they're five and pick them up and take them to school. You know, a parent with a child with a disability may have to go through a lot of advocacy just to even get the local public school to even take their child. And then you might have to negotiate a whole other realm of things just to even let them be allowed to ride the bus and yada, yada, yada. So there's, so you multiply that to school, Cub Scouts, you know, local recreation events and church. And this is why parents of kids with disabilities often don't come to church. They just don't have the energy to advocate in one more place. So my plea to you is that, you know, don't make them, you know? I mean, we have the opportunity to try to make the church a very accepting and welcoming place for people with disabilities by choice, you know? And so anyway, that's just another one of those differences of degree. And family relationships, you know, you can, I don't know what statistics to quote because I've heard a lot of different ones, but, you know, bottom line is that there is a higher divorce rate for parents of children with disabilities than otherwise. And Also a high level of stress for siblings, who often are sort of the forgotten entities in the family. You know, a lot of focus can end up on a child or another family member with a disability, and the sibling can just end up sort of lost on the fringes a little bit. And so having a ministry to siblings is a really, really valuable thing to do. And giving them things to do outside of the realm of their social space in their family, you know, things that they might not get to do otherwise because maybe their parents can't do those things with them. But our minister of pastoral care at our church came and talked to me at the hospital one time when Tim was in, I think, for like his third or fourth hospitalization. And he used a really good analogy about how every family has a pie, you know, a pie of life, and that's just by definition, because Tim had disabilities, his piece of the pie was probably going to be bigger, you know, than our other pieces of the pie were. But he said it was going to be take an active emphasis on our part to make sure that didn't become disproportionately bigger. And if you think about it sort of theologically, you know, if you think about the families being like a circle, you know, God should always be at the center of the circle and all of us are on the rim, you know, and sometimes what happens in a family with a child with tremendous needs, a child ends up, you know, in the center of the circle. And whether a child does or doesn't have disabilities, when anybody ends up in the center of the circle instead of God, it's a form of idolatry of sorts, you know, when you think about it. So trying to keep balance in family life, you know, another picture of it, it's kind of like when you get those, I'm not a mechanic, but, you know, your car and they put the weights on your wheels, you know, that has a name, George, right? You know, and so, you know what your tire feels like when those balance weights or whatever are off, you know, and the tire goes wop, 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 you know. I mean, the goal in family life is to really have your tire balanced in such a way that it runs smoothly. And so every family faces its challenges, but those challenges are more so when the family's affected by disability. So how can you help a family that's really trying to find their stride, to find their new normal? Be engaged with the family. If they're not attending church, go find them, right? You probably have lots of people on the rolls of your church who have been affected by disability one sort and have kind of dropped off the radar screen. You know, so go engage those families. For families that maybe you're reaching out to that maybe aren't believers, you're going to have to be where they are first before they're going to come to where you are. So it takes some active engagement in the community. The second would be use good boundaries. This is that idea. If you look at Galatians 6, I like this passage in Galatians 6:2, where it says, carry each other's burdens, and in this way you will fulfill the law of Christ. If anyone thinks he is something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. Each one should test his own actions. Then he can take pride in himself without comparing himself to somebody else, for each one should carry his own load. And if you've ever read the book Boundaries by Townsend and Cloud, they talk about the difference between the actual words behind these two English words, burden and load. And that the idea that carry one another's burdens, that word burden really is equivalent to the idea of a boulder. It's something that if you didn't help the person, it would crush them, right? That requires 911 intervention, right? That requires the active intentional involvement of the church to lift that boulder so that family isn't crushed by it. The other word, load, is more like a backpack, right? And a backpack is something that you need to carry yourself. And as a family is learning to embrace disability and really incorporate it into their lives, they will often switch from what might have been a crisis-oriented boulder into a backpack, right? And it may be a heavy backpack with a lot of responsibilities, but it still will eventually shift from the one to the other. And so it takes a lot of discernment as you're involved to really understand then how your assistance needs to change from crisis-oriented involvement to encouragement and support that really actually helps the family to strengthen their muscles to carry that backpack. That kind of assistance can come through practical assistance with respite care, for example, to encouragement. You know, Bible talks a lot about encouragement. You know, encouragement is just a very practical way of lifting people up. It's amazing how far people can go with a little bit of encouragement. And so not just practical supports, but also a lot of encouragement of the parents, encouragement of the child with a disability, encouragement of the siblings, and perspective. You know, we talked earlier about being a gracious truth teller. That goes, you know, on through the process, and helping people to get their perspective. If you get a family that's stuck indefinitely in help crisis mode and just can't seem to make that shift to really carrying their own backpack, then you may need to seek some professional advice in terms of helping them to make that jump. So I'm out of time, so I'm going to stop at this point. So you guys can ask questions if you want. I know that's a marathon. I told you it was too many things to put in one seminar, but I hope it gives you an overview. What are the issues a family feels with an onset of disability? It's like September 11th experience, right? What is the whole issue of acceptance, right? Acceptance is developing a piece about disability in the life of a family, and it's the whole idea that that's a process that they have to negotiate. That involves those five R's, right? And then the idea of developing a new normal life, being able to differentiate between what's a crisis and what's a part of a life that incorporates disability, which will involve differences of degree in a variety of different areas over typical families. And so when you start, what helps you have a compassion on a family that's touched by disability is, on the one hand, you can identify with them in all these different areas, because you can say, well, I can identify with those different things and extrapolate them. But if you think about extrapolating those things in six or eight things at one time, it helps you understand where some of the stress comes from. And just like Diane said this morning, you can't change that. I mean, you can't make it go away, but you can engage. You know, you can engage it and bring assistance, and you can help them to find Christ in that difficulty, even as you are physically being the hands and feet of Christ in their lives. So, does anybody have a question about anything, or overwhelmed you, put you to sleep? Go ahead.
I'm just curious. I enjoyed the title of your book, Same Lake, Different Boat. What went behind that title? I mean, there's something there.
You know, yeah.
I mean, I guess I could stumble around and figure out some of it, but
yeah.
What was behind it? What was your thinking, or the publisher's thinking when you...
Sure. For the tape, the question is why the title Same Lake, Different Boat? And because the idea that I think people tend to think of disability as something entirely other, you know, something entirely different that they can't identify with, and people with disabilities as somehow being entirely different than people without diagnosable disabilities. And so my point was to say, you know, we're all essentially the same in what gives us value and meaning in life, but we're experientially different in that we all, and not just disability, but other things. And so, in a sense, we all operate in the same lake, but we're in different boats. And instead, people sometimes tend to look at it as like different lakes entirely, right? Or the other extreme is that sort of happy American melting pot, we're all in the same boat. Well, not really, you know? I mean, so it's sort of trying to straddle between those two views, the postmodern view on the one hand that different groups have no ability to actually identify with each other, and the error on the other hand that somehow your life isn't any different than mine. So, anybody else? Go ahead.
How has disability ministry changed your church family?
Oh, that's a good question. His question is, how's disability ministry changed my church family? We were really blessed in that our pastors always preach a strong foundation of mercy and justice ministry all along. So as far as incorporating disability ministry, it was not a difficult jump to make, you know, because our congregation sort of already got it, you know, as far as the bigger picture of mercy and justice. How it changed our congregation, I think it helped us to really see the gift in every person that I think probably we would not have seen the same way. You know, like I said about Tim before, I said, you know, it's giftedness in a different form of packaging. You know, it causes you to see a person when you really look at them as a person created in the image of God and a person who is endowed with spiritual gifts for the common good, right? And to say, wow, those are biblical truths. Now I need to see what that looks like in this person. That's been, I think, really a real eye-opening and a real blessing. Like, Tim has very good musical gifts, and he can read music, and he plays in the praise band at our church on two Sundays a month. And I think that's been really people, it's so easy for people to look at people with disabilities only in terms of their needs, you know, and so and learning to see people with disabilities as those who have just as much to bring to bless the body of Christ in terms of their gifts, I think has been one of the big things. We've used the Sanctity of Human Life Sundays. That's a really good opportunity to focus on disability education through worship, you know, and having people with disabilities participate in the worship service more, you know, notably. And one year, Freddie and Timmy read Psalm 121, you know, back and forth, like alternating verses. And you could have dropped a pin in the sanctuary because I think most people didn't realize Tim could read, you know, until he got up there and started reading. And it was, it sounds like such a little thing, but it really shows how many of our prejudices I think we carry around in terms of our expectations or what some people call the, what's the right phrase? Sort of philosophy of low expectations, you know, that just low expectations that just really aren't warranted. So does that help? Is that what you wanted? Yeah. Anybody else? Question? Okay. Thanks a lot for coming. Oh, you have what's your name?
Michelle.
Hey, okay, Michelle. Yes.
Because where I attend church, it's a smaller church, and most times smaller churches are less accessible.
Mm-hmm.
But I find that was more that a smaller church is better for me because I flourish in more closely relationships.
Okay.
And I just find that bigger churches are more accessible, but there's less fellowship and
right.
less contact for me.
Right.
Because I feel like that the smaller the congregation is, the more likely I am to have an impact or like so that I can maybe combat some stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just wondering, does your organization work with that? And is there different conferences that I may be able to attend?
Yes. Yep, my organization with M&A works with PCA churches, so Presbyterian Church in America churches. If you're looking for a church, for a group that would work with churches from any, you know, denomination, Johnny and Friends would probably be your best bet. I almost forgot to say, 10th Presbyterian is having an event on April 12th, and I'm going to be speaking at that, and they're going to have some testimonies and all done there as well. That would be a good thing to invite people from your church to. And do you have a sign-up sheet with you?
There's a sign-up sheet on the information table on here, and most of you may have received a little card that has to say the date and has an email address. It's actually 10th CSN Children with Special Needs, so 10thcsn@msn.com.
So 10thcsn@msn.com, okay. Right.
Like, I was expressing to people, I didn't come to faith through my family, so
right.
I didn't have that support.
Right.
So I was just wondering, if there's, any information that you could give me,
I would be glad to talk to you. You can, I'll give you my card and we can email or talk on the phone. So, Johnny and Friends is having, there's a group in Lancaster called Lancaster Christian Council on Disability, and they, in conjunction with Johnny and Friends, will probably be having a conference in October 2009, which will be a big conference. You know, we had one in 2006, and we had 24 workshops and multiple plenary presenters. So that's a great place to get resources. And there is a Johnny and Friends office in the Philly area. Just one. Okay. Yeah, I'll get you connected with them. They're great, great people. Guy that runs that office has cerebral palsy himself, and he's just a great disability advocate. So you bring up a good point, Michelle, that sometimes churches, you know, you have a small church and you have architectural barriers because they don't have the money to, and Johnny Friends does also have some grant money, you know, that you can get with. So you run into architectural barriers, but maybe not so many social barriers in a smaller group, and that's a really wise observation, I think, on your part there. But in the bigger churches, a lot of times there's the money for the adaptations, and yet trying to make one of the things, we just had a big Lancaster Christian Council event in October on church, the subject of church culture and disability, and how church culture is one of the barriers to disability ministry for people, because every church has this set of unwritten rules that aren't even necessarily biblical. But when you go in and you run into one of those in order to try to facilitate change, you know, everything kind of breaks loose. So it's, and the bigger and the older the church, the more likely it is that you will run into substantial church culture issues when you try to institute change. And so it doesn't mean you can't, it doesn't mean God's not capable of changing that church. It just takes an awareness that those things have to be addressed. So
mm-hmm. And you know, like, I can't, if I come across a person with a disability, I can't say to them, come to my church.
Right.
Because, yeah, it's accessible for me, but there's a lot of things that I have to do in order to get to where I need to go. Even
yeah.
though that relationship for me is a strong relationship, and I believe that's why I came to be,
yeah.
I can't welcome other people to my congregation the way that it is now.
Right. So maybe you'll be the catalyst for change there, right?
Yeah. I'm trying, but, you know,
it takes time. They're one step at a time. Yep. Thanks. I'm going to close in prayer because we're out of time. And I'll be glad to talk to any of you further afterwards if you'd like. Father, we just thank you for the chance to be here today and the opportunity to talk about these issues. I just pray, Father, that you would give us genuinely loving and caring hearts towards individuals and families touched by disability, who were those who you so clearly loved when you walked on the face of this earth, and how you gave people with disabilities so much of your attention. I just pray, Father, that we would follow the example of Christ, that we would just genuinely be the hands and feet of Jesus to those who cross our path, and that we'd be intentional about that as well. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.